Get ready to deep dive into the world of digital transformation, where we explore the latest trends, innovations, and challenges shaking up industries. Join us as we decode the secrets behind successful digital strategies and hear from experts who are at the forefront of disrupting the status quo. In each episode, we'll unravel the mysteries of the digital realm and uncover the hidden opportunities that lie within. From artificial intelligence to blockchain, from automation to cybersecurity, we'll leave no digital stone unturned. But hold on tight, because this podcast isn't your average tech talk. We're injecting a hefty dose of wit and humor into every episode, making learning about digital transformation an absolute blast. So if you're ready to embrace the digital revolution with a smile on your face, tune in to the Digital Disruption Podcast and get ready to be entertained, informed, and inspired. Don't miss out on the fun. Subscribe now and join us on this wild digital journey.
Hello and good morning. How are you doing now, Patrick?
Hey, Doug, doing well. Good evening to you. How are things for you?
Cold, chilly, like the hearts of some corporations, you know, the corporations who will not ask for my consent.
So, hey, speaking of which, did I tell you about my new idea that I had?
Oh no.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. No, this is really amazing. So it's just hot off the presses. I have an idea for a new generative AI application, and it's, the name of it is See You Later. And it's, here's the concept. Let me know what you think. So it'll be a GPT that replaces your CEO with a CEO bot. And we will, we'll write the application and we'll license content from the top four MBA programs globally. And so we'll train the model on all of the latest and greatest business thinking from the MBA world. And then we, you know, since CEO pay is about, you know, 1,000 times your average worker's salary on average, you get, you know, we'll get all the CEO jargon with none of the overhead. What do you think of that idea? Too bold?
I mean, as an individual and as a person of the working class, I approve.
Anyway, we know we love CEOs. We're just having a little fun, but you know, I think we'll have your robo executive spouting synergy, diversity, efficiency, and equity in no time. And you know, since it's an AI inspired generative pre-trained transformer, you might end up with some unexpected combinations as well, like diversified efficiency or efficient yet diversified synergies. I think the sky is truly the limit with See You Later. What do you think? Should we develop it?
I mean, CEOs will end up using our bots, but still getting paid. So the CEOs always win.
Anyway, well, we'll see.
Have you been on YouTube lately?
Have what?
Have you been on YouTube? Do you watch YouTube a lot?
I do watch YouTube, but for really specific things like related to fishing and hunting and stuff. But what should I be paying attention to that I missed?
So this is like a personal thing. I follow a lot of young creators, but out of like every five videos that I watch, I see an ad. And this ad is about a platform X that removes your data from data brokerages. And I'm like,
oh, wow.
That's interesting. I'm seeing a trend. Like this wasn't, like I usually would have seen ad every 20, and it was one platform. I will not name anyone, but it was like one platform that I know the name of on top of my head. And then I see two and I see three. And I'm like, oh, those are content. Like most of them are content creators, like small people, like small indie star, like indie YouTube channels and people who are younger than me. I mean, I am a millennial. I was born in 1996. And I know that, you know, a lot of changes are happening that are led now by Gen Z, and one of them is actually the topic of like gathering data and consent, which was one of the things that our new content creator Shuru, she actually wrote a blog that is targeted towards Gen Zs, and it was amazing about the consent management platforms. And so I thought that it may be an interesting topic that we cover. We covered it on the blog, but I think that we should give it some space, like a millennial, and what do you consider yourself now? A lost generation?
Definitely, I'm part of the lost. I appreciate you reminding me of that, but yes, indeed. So, no,
So
I
do
think,
people who are not Gen Z
yeah,
talking
no, I
about
think
this?
privacy, yeah, I think privacy and consent's a great topic. We haven't looked at it in depth on our podcast yet. We've certainly talked about it, but we haven't really devoted a full episode to it. Yeah, I think seeing where we are to start 2024 would be important. We'll get out our crystal ball a little bit and talk about some of the trends we see coming and just, I guess, the facts as well, right? So, yeah, I mean, any particular questions come to mind, or you want me to kind of, it's obviously not something I pay attention to because it's important to our clients and our business. So I have some thoughts, but if you have any specific questions you want to start with, shoot.
I have, but I know that you have been working with one of our clients on their CMP platform. So I wanna jump in the middle of like the things that you're gonna be saying and asking some questions rather than asking the
Okay.
general questions that I could ask now. So,
Okay.
I mean, you can give us the brief of what is CMP and what is used for, because a lot of people know about CMPs, but I think there is room for people to improve their
Sure.
knowledge about CMPs.
Sure. So, I mean, a CMP is a consent management platform. It's essentially a tool. It usually involves relatively simple code snippet that you add to your website, and it helps you. And then you configure the back end, right, the way you need to. But then it helps to support and manage your both securing user consent for tracking purposes, but also actually having a record of that consent, from a regulatory standpoint. And it, the good tools, we work quite often with OneTrust. As an enterprise solution, it facilitates, again, having a clear, timestamp record of consent. It makes it easy for people to withdraw consent should they choose to. And from a regulatory standpoint, and I'll jump into the details of this in a minute, but being able to fine-tune the consent protocol that you're complying with based on a user's geographic location is important. If if you are trying to, for example, serve a particular consent protocol to EU users, say, versus California users versus somebody in Brazil, right? Having an enterprise tool that helps kind of automate that and streamline that is really important. I'm going to get into why I think there may be a case to be made for really truly mature organizations that are doing privacy and consent well to move away from that kind of a practice. And I'll tell you what my philosophically why I think that. But I think if you are trying to comply sort of letter of the law, each regulatory schema that your company falls under, I think an enterprise tool like a OneTrust is really, really important. It's really hard to do a homegrown solution for that, or try and manage it yourself. Just a lot of there's a lot of needless overhead, let's put it that way. Just to kind of put some context around this, right? Everybody knows GDPR, CCPA, CPRA in the California context. Most people probably know like some of the bigger emerging economies and regions have data privacy coming, Brazil, there's quite a few individual states that are now kind of on that bandwagon in the United States. The MENA region, Saudi Arabia has some pretty interesting data privacy laws coming out. The Gulf states as a whole. Just to put it in a global context, put a pin in this. Last year at this time in January, there were about 120 countries with data privacy laws in place or that fell under a regional purview. At the start of 2024, we've crossed the 140 mark. Mid last year, we were in the high 130s. So, I mean, it's safe to say if it wasn't already true in 2023 and 2024, privacy and consent, data privacy, data security, those are definitely emerging as a global standard. Even though the regulations around it, there's no global standard yet. The concept of kind of people's basic dignity in a connected world being tied to having control over the data that's collected about them and what's done with it, that is emerging as a basic principle. In the EU, it's for a lot of people, it's basically considered a human right. I wouldn't say that that is an agreed upon principle globally, but close to that. I think, certainly the idea that there should be protections and that people are entitled to those protections, where pretty much everybody is forced to be connected in order to be productive economically and socially, right? Culturally, commercially, right? So it is a concern globally, and rightly so. I think we will see some regular, as routinization of those standards over time. It will never probably be identical. Like, we probably will never have a global privacy law. I doubt it. But even like the way they kind of worked out the issue with Google Analytics data, right, with the EU and the US. I mean, they basically had to negotiate a new kind of a treaty, essentially, with the that both sides, both the EU and the US could agree on in terms of data security and privacy standards for data that's going cross border, right? That was the latest concern around whether Google Analytics, data was compliant with GDPR and stuff. So you will see these international agreements. Saudi Arabia has very stringent cross border data portability restrictions. So again, that the idea that your citizens' data has some kind of integrity and inherent right to protection, that's also emerging as an important idea. And it's it coming from some at least from a like a non-MENA perspective, it catches many people by surprise where some of these leading edge protections are coming from. I've worked, with lots of colleagues in Cairo, Dubai, different parts of the world. Nothing catches me by surprise anymore in terms of where the most cutting edge regulations and laws are coming from. But it's pretty
Yeah, I mean,
interesting.
citizens' data is a matter of national security, to be honest. Like, you don't want anyone messing with the country's data, demographics, or any kind of data, to be honest. Like, it could be weaponized, and that's the big scare.
Yeah, I think you bring up a really good point. I think especially with proliferation of AI, especially generative AI type solutions, we've already seen some of the risks come to fruition here in the United States. There was recently this robocall, where it was like impersonating President Biden's voice, but that could, you could easily have something on the left impersonating Trump or Lindsey Graham or some other, GOP person. Certainly there are websites where you can like pay AI developers a bounty to create deep fake content, right? And
Yeah.
reward the most authentic appearing fake, right? This is all really insidious, like nefarious type stuff, in my opinion. So no surprise, right alongside of growing privacy and consent regulations, you also have the likelihood, you're already seeing sort of in Europe, we'll see elsewhere, there will be regulations around generative AI technologies and probably AI in general, right? To balance the social goods that it potentially brings against those risks of real harm. And so you'll have to, if you are using embedded AI technology, if you're creating, if you're automating ad creative messaging, anything where the content is getting increasingly out of your control behind a bit of a black box, like you probably will fall under some kind of regulatory guidance at some point, right? Which is like you're responsible to ensure you're not doing harm with these technologies.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the questions that I came up across, because when I was doing research about like consent and consent management and stuff like that, is a lot of companies, organizations, and enterprises actually implement the CMPs wrong, and they do not comply with regulations, which to me seemed interesting because you know, like, how hard would it be to like implement a consent management platform, and why do a lot of people just get it wrong, like classifications and stuff like that? I don't get it. I mean, I get it after I've talked with Morsi, but for our audiences, I wanna explain it for our audience.
Sure. I mean, you have everything from, and I'll say thankfully, I don't work with any brands on the far end of the spectrum I'm about to describe, but you have everything from companies who literally just completely half-assed, implemented consent management or not at all, right? And just said, we'll take the risk. Hopefully we'll get our hands slapped. And if it's worse than that, then we'll do something. So you do have some very big enterprises on that end of the spectrum, just sort of like wait and see. We're not going to invest in this until we have to. Like I said, thankfully, I don't work with any companies like that. Then you have kind of in the middle, you have a lot of companies that are they have perfectly good intentions in terms of they want to comply with the regulations that are emerging. They want to give their users the ability to consent, but they're trying to do it in a way that, complies with each regulatory regime, right, that they fall under. So if you're a global company, that at this point that could be a lot, right? But and even just kind of complying with the key ones that apply to you, like GDPR and CCPA, for example, are sufficiently different, right? And then if you were going to do GDPR or CCPA, and the rest of the world as a kind of a simple solution, right? You still that's three different templates you have to get right, three different sets of rules. You also have to scan your website, right? If you're using any kind of like auto cookie blocking in the absence of consent, you have to regularly scan your website. You have to classify cookies. So there's some ongoing maintenance that's part of it. There's also just more moving parts than people realize. To truly be compliant, your privacy policy has to be totally up to date, which also requires maintenance ongoing. It's a good case for an enterprise solution like a OneTrust, where you can get support from them. You also it just it it it's built to support multiple privacy and consent regulatory schemas. So that in that middle area, I think there's a lot of companies that are trying to comply. They're also trying to preserve their own measurement and ability to remarket and all these things at the same time that they're trying to comply. So for users who are okay with their data being collected and used. You know, they're trying to make sure that that's happening as robustly as possible. Also not breaking your site functionality, the recommendation engines, the different tools that you use as, you know, third-party extensions that also rely on code snippets, you know, customer engagement tools. So there's just a lot more moving parts than people realize that are all tied in quite closely with that consent management piece. And I mean, quite frankly, if you do everything right, you can count on losing 20 to 30% visibility because people who either don't opt in where their opt-in is a requirement or who choose to opt out. There's a little bit of, I guess, not really malicious, but just kind of self-serving complacency, I guess, you know, in the sense of like, can we get in line with the letter of the regulation or the law without going too much further than that? Which that kind of gets to my ultimate point in terms of a really mature organization, right? We've all been talking about how important first party data is, right? How important zero party data is. And just to, I don't know why we've coined these all so much jargon, but apparently it's important to have jargon to make our hourly billable rates what they are. But
True.
zero party data, let's talk about, we used to just talk about first party data. Now we have to talk about zero party data too. So zero party data is the data users actually give to you, like in a form, right? Like they choose to willingly give to you that you collect. So name, you know, first name, last name, email, phone number. They give you other information as well, potentially social media profiles, whatever they choose to give you, right? That's zero party data versus like passively collected data that you own, let's say behavioral analytics data, that's first party data. So really, zero party data is the gold standard, right? In terms of reliability, especially if you use like email validation on the inbound, if you gate your content right and you make sure you get a valid email address, you exclude Gmail if it's a B2B context, whatever the, you know, the best practice parameters are. But zero party data is what you want. For people to give you zero party data relies on, they have to trust you, I guess, first and foremost, right? If they think you're a scam, a fly-by-night organization, if they, you know, like I would never put an actual legitimate email address in something that I don't, that I have a question about the legitimacy of. I just won't, and a lot of people won't. I also won't just give my email address if I don't think there's something of value in it. Like if it's a really, really cool hunting and fishing and target shooting website that I love their content, and I want to get on their newsletter, or I want to join their forum, of course I'll give them my email address. It's they have got really good content that I want to see more of, right? If I want to hear from them, and you know, and I'm happy to give that information to them. Similarly, like in a B2B context, right? One of the reasons why really good white papers are developed and different guides and ebooks, all the kinds of glossy takeaway content that we know can work for a lead generation purposes, right? You have to, you know, convince people that you have something to offer them in exchange for what is in fact valuable information about them. There's a reason you want it, and they have to have a reason to want to give it to you. In order for that kind of ecosystem to work, and it's just going to become more and more important. Especially if you want that information from somebody before they decide to be your customer, right? Like they have to trust you. They have to see value there, which means if you can put privacy, consent, data security, and if you can like with a straight face say that you like respect people's like basic digital dignity, like as a company, like you stand to win in that in that scenario, right? People will want to give your information, their information to you in exchange for what they see as valuable from you. And if they truly do trust what you're doing, and you do stand by, you do exercise due diligence with their data. You do have data security measures in place. You do make sure you're not leaking that data to places it shouldn't be. You do use that data for the purposes you say you're going to use it for. You respect people's preferences. If you collect an email and a phone number, but somebody tells you they want to hear from you via SMS, but all you ever do is email them, that's stupid, right? So, but all of those things are part of this, right? Like consent means, right? Not to be too crass about it, but right, it's like your marketing tools, right? It's not the size of your marketing tools, it's how you use them, right? But in order to use those tools increasingly in the world today, you need consent to do so, as you rightly should. So use those tools in the way that you've been given permission to by those users, right? It's kind of as simple as that. And from a data standpoint, use that data in the way you've been given permission to. And I don't see, so this kind of gets to my, I guess my fundamental point around that, which is truly mature organizations are not chasing regulations. If you really respect your customers and your prospective customers' privacy, and their data, and you truly value it, you truly value them, the regulations should be catching up to you. That's really how strongly I feel about this. The regulations should be catching up to you. You should be soliciting consent for the things you do. You should be telling people why you want their information, what you're going to do with it. Your policies should reflect that. It shouldn't be written in such a way that only lawyers can understand what your privacy policy means. If everything you're doing is a CYA move, you're looking at this wrong. Not that you shouldn't be doing those things. Like, don't get me wrong, there's a huge amount of risk. Like, you should be consulting your lawyers. You should be consulting your consent, your compliance teams. I'm not suggesting that. But if you can sit around the table with your product owners, your marketers, your website developers, your compliance team, and if you can honestly say, hey, the regulations are catching up to us, we're not catching up to the regulations, that's got to be a good feeling. That means you're doing something right. And you can, I think with a straight face, you can say, like, we are capitalizing on this trust economy that is becoming more important. And I think you kind of brought it up from a, the kind of Gen Z perspective, like that, like people will abandon, people will get outraged and they will abandon ship. They don't have loyalty to companies they don't think align with things they feel are important, right?
Oh no, not at all. Especially with Gen Z. They
I
will
mean,
ditch you in the nearest curve.
yeah. And I don't think it's just a generational thing only, because organizations like Edelman, they do these annual, like, the state of, like, trust, right? Like, on the digital, like, trust on the internet and everything. And I mean, people across the board, if they get a bad taste in their mouth over, how their data is being used, or they don't, if they start having bad experiences around anything that impacts trust and credibility, people who otherwise would have been loyal to your brand will move on. Absolutely.
Thing is, I don't see the same, and I think this will be like the closing notes, but I don't see the same like fight for privacy and fine for data protection that Gen Z and millennials and Gen Z and Gen Alpha, I think that's the new one. So I don't see the old generations fighting like the new generations, but I see the old generations adapting because the new generations are the ones who are buying, the ones with the purchasing power. Like it's quite interesting how Gen Zs are shaping up the world now, which is not really interesting, but it's a breath of fresh air, to be honest. Like, because we got abused a lot, and just like we said, I don't have anything to hide. But Gen Z is like, yeah, no, if you don't delete my data, I will delete you off the world. And then they post a viral TikTok, and then the company is in hot, boiling water. Oh, it's quite interesting.
So they're the masters of cancel culture, huh?
I mean, not just, cancel culture has its ups and downs, but yeah, they are the masters of the cancel culture and holding companies accountable. They are interesting. I think this is why businesses need to be focusing in a Gen Z mentality. And I've had a discussion before, and it was called, "Why do you need a Gen Z in your company?" And it opened my eye to the fights that Gen Z has is much more different than the fights I have. But at the end of the day, each of us have their weighted opinions, and each of us have the strong that their place in the business. So I can't have a business which is just millennials and older people, and I can't have a business with Gen Zs and just younger people. I need to have a mixed balance between people who knows, like, how do Gen Z work? How does Gen Z, think of me? How can I cater to Gen Z? Because do you remember what was it, like the episode where you had like an old guy wearing a cab that is behind and holding a scooter? I will remember it, and I will add it later in the thing, this podcast, for anyone who's going to be watching on YouTube. But it reminds me of this one. But yeah, do you have any closing notes?
Oh, no, I think, I mean, you bring up a really good point in terms of that, even with something as that seems as big as privacy, consent, data security, et cetera, all these things, there may be generational differences in how people perceive the threats, the expectations, the implications. I know that this year we'll probably start to see things like more. I mean, just crystal ball here. I've seen other people talking about this as well. I think it's likely we will see increased enforcement of these regulations this year. We will also see the enforcement being kind of in aggregate in some cases. So, like class action lawsuit type enforcement versus one-off enforcement, which means, in some ways, it'll streamline the enforcement process, but it'll also balloon the risk, right? So you will now be, as a large organization, you could be facing, big collective risk from this versus kind of one-off nuisance risk from this. I think that's a big difference. I think that ties right into sort of generational viral. The last thing you want is a sort of a viral class action lawsuit, right? That would be a kind of a worst in breed sort of a use case. You don't want to be the person that is at the end of that use case.
Nope.
So yeah, and I think you bring up a really good point that not related to privacy and consent, but generationally speaking, maybe we're not thinking of DEI in all the ways we should. There's a generational component that we kind of need to, I guess we need to see eye to eye with a kind of breadth of ages and generational experiences as well. And
It's all good to make fun of one another for our different age groups, but when we respect each other for the different perspectives we bring, it's a little more fruitful.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if any Gen Zs listen to us, just let us know, let us know where you see your data, where you see yourself fighting for your data, what active measures are you taking? How would you like us to communicate to cut like to companies that this is what we heard from Gen Z and this is how they want the data to be treated? But yeah, I mean, follow us on LinkedIn, speak us to, you have my email. I'm pretty sure if you dug up 5 minutes, you'll find it somewhere. Unfortunately, you'll find it. But we have public profiles on LinkedIn. Feel free to message us and let's have a discussion. But that's all the time that we have. Thank you so much, Patrick, and I will see you in the next episode when you get older.
All right. Thanks a lot.
See
Talk to you
ya.
soon.
And that's a wrap for this episode of the Digital Disruption Podcast. We hope you enjoyed our deep dive into the world of digital transformation and gained valuable insights to help navigate the ever-changing landscape. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us on our website, esens.com, or connect with us on social media. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and stay tuned for more exciting discussions on the forefront of digital innovation. Remember, the future is now, and it's time to embrace the power of transformation. Thanks for listening, and until next time.